So the art sector is very, very small. So when a new person comes in, like when I came in, everyone knew I was the new person. And everyone would like come to introduce me. And I was just like this one brown person, let alone the fact that I cover my head in a sea of just like white people.
Start seeing the human behind the art.
I don't have to tell the stories of a billion people I don't know who happen to look like me.
And who's making the decisions and who's in the door.
Hi, and welcome to The Colour Cycle, a podcast that aims to disrupt cultural whitewashing and asks, does our creative sector look like Australia? I'm Lena Nahlus from Diversity Arts Australia, or DARTS for short, an organisation that advocates for an arts and screen sector that looks like Australia. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of Australia from over 500 nations and to pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. So our next guest is Zainab Ziad. She's someone who we had on for one of our short DART segments, but we thought that the conversation was so interesting that we wanted to bring her back for a longer conversation. In this episode, Zainab tells us about her experiences as a performance poet and a producer, and also the assumptions that people have made about her. So she's from Pakistan. She wears a headscarf. She's lived all around the world, but people assume that she's a refugee or that she's lived a life of hardship or poverty and that her work should reflect this. And when she strays from that narrative or she's not kind of fulfilling that narrative that's expected of her, she talks about the difficulties of actually being acknowledged as a performer or making work outside of those narratives. But that's not her story, and she talks about her story being one of privilege. So we'll talk to her about changing the narrative. How do you change stereotypes or assumptions made about artists of colour? And we meet an artist whose work really challenges our presumed narratives, Kevin Bathman. His work about Chindian communities, people, Chinese and Indian couples who intermarry in Southeast Asia, it doesn't fit easily into most categories. He also talks about the challenges of being a first-generation artist and how he's negotiated these. We'll play our usual game of darts with one lucky contestant, and the winner of our five-star awards fits right into this theme of changing the narrative. So hang around for that.
And I left for a few years, and when I came back, I had started covering my head. And all of a sudden, I was this diverse person before I could pass off as like Spanish or Greek or whatever, but now I was visibly the other in a lot of ways. And because I'd grown up in international communities and I'd gone to Brown University, so I'd always lived in a very privileged kind of space and took for granted diversity. It was just sort of my norm and it was my normal. So coming into that for me, just as a performance poet, was a bit of a culture shock, so to speak. And there was a huge gap for people that were a little different.
That was Zainab speaking at last year's PAC Australia, or Australian Performing Arts Conference, at a breakout session we hosted called Are We There Yet? Look out for the bonus episode with a live recording from that event. Zainab Ziad is a performance poet and works as an associate producer at Performing Lines WA in Perth. She also co-founded Illuminate and You and Me for Humanity, a safe space for culturally and linguistically diverse people in Australia, and create some real change. Thanks, Zainab, for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
I really like what you said about it kind of takes one small step, like one incremental step to kind of make change and being able to break it down, because it can be quite overwhelming for people when they don't know.
Yeah. How to tackle the whole thing.
Yes. Now, this is interesting for you because when I spoke to you, you kind of were saying you don't consider yourself to be a migrant, more of a traveller spending time here. Okay, so in terms of people who are not born in Australia and are already practising artists, what are some of the obstacles for first-generation artists? And you can draw this either from your own experiences or from experiences of those you're working with at the moment at Performing Lines.
So just to give a bit of context in terms of how and why I do or don't consider Australia home, I think I'm in a very unique position where I had the privilege of kind of growing up all over the world. So ethnically, I do consider myself Pakistani and do think of my rootedness to be in the soil in Pakistan. But at the same time, at the cost of sounding a bit cliche, but I did grow up all over the world. So kind of in a lot of ways, I think I embody the space of a citizen of the world in a lot of ways, which means that home is kind of everywhere. And when I was first growing up, home had to be a very tangible place. So I looked for home in places. And because I moved from like Romania to Yemen to Wales, it was always like, if I love one place so much, can I love another place just as much? And does that make Pakistan less of a home for me? Or can Romania and Yemen be just as much home for me? And so I think my art at that point tried to answer a lot of those questions of what was home and how as an artist looking for home in a place, how could I find that? How could I reconcile sort of that sense of belonging? And then I think as you grow a bit older and life became a lot more transient and a lot more nomadic, and when I went to boarding school and university, home became more about the people. And so it was looking for home in people. And it didn't mean that I looked for home in Pakistanis, but just looked for home in people who had the same values as me or resonated with me, and they became my tribe and the place where I belonged. But because I grew up saying goodbye all the time and leaving places, it was not also something that I could keep with me all the time. And so it became a lot about finding home in myself. And so I think that was the way that my art became a way for me to explore what home looked like within myself. And so when I come to Australia as an artist, I don't really consider Australia home in sense of like the tangible sense of home, of like where I'm rooted, where my house is, where my family is. But at the same time, because home is very much in myself and in the present, Australia is home, right? Right now for me, that is my reality. And so I am an artist living in Australia, and this is home for me for some time, and I don't know how long that will be, but it is. And so I may not have the same experiences as like a first generation artist who's come here from another place, or someone who grew up here as an artist. A lot of the barriers to creating art as a diverse person are very similar, because the lack of opportunities as a diverse person are not, no one asks you, oh, so have you lived in Australia for 5 years or 10 years, or were you born here as a diverse artist? We actually don't even get to those questions. We only just get to our name, right? And then like they look at our name and they're like, oh, okay, sounds kind of foreign, no matter that I went to Brown University or have all these accomplishments. Like, no one ever even like goes down that line. So in a way, the barriers to accessing the arts, I think, are universal for emerging and diverse artists in a way that is hard to grow as an artist, because I think one of the greatest lack of access, or like the greatest obstacles I found, is that diverse artists just don't have enough opportunities that they can take where they can grow. So you get to a point where you have these young actors and directors, they're emerging, but because they have mentorship or opportunities, they sort of like over the years grow. So when they come to a place where they're like 25 or 30 or like mid-career, they have a lot of experience and expertise behind them that allows them to then take their art to the next level. But their peers on the same level who are of a diverse background just haven't had enough of those opportunities. So they just haven't even had enough of that growth and experience. So that's where the disadvantage comes in, that they actually can't even take on the position of, say, an associate producer or an associate director, because they just don't even have had those like very basic opportunities from the beginning.
For a lot of first-generation artists who I've worked with, they've often had really established practices in their home countries or the country that they've come from. I mean, some people have spent a lot of time in, you know, in refugee camps in countries, yeah. But I've worked with artists who have actually got really established practices as artists and are quite accomplished as artists. When they come to Australia, their art is often not seen as relevant or, you know, contemporary Australian. And so I guess I'm also talking about those experiences, and I'm not sure whether you've come across those with artists who you're working with, where it's not only about them those who want to develop skills in the arts, but there are people out there who've come to Australia as really accomplished, you know, theatre directors or writers or, you know, performers,
yeah.
and then suddenly they're here and they're not able to access support and funding or even acknowledgement of their existence.
Actually, that's a really good question because, I mean, one of the main reasons that we come to conferences like BACS and APACA is not necessarily just to sell work and pitch work. It's to make connections, right? And it's those building of relationships between producers and presenters and artists and producers. And it's actually those relationships that a lot of times the ones that are not begun because of some intention of like, oh, you're going to present my work in the future. They may strike up a conversation with someone over coffee or something else. They may talk about everything except for art. But it's those relationships that actually allow you later on, and they come back to you in different ways. And it's just like, oh, I met so-and-so at APACA once, and now they're at so-and-so venue. Let me just hit them up, and you strike a conversation, and that opens doors. And I think that's the great disadvantage for a lot of established artists when they come into Australia, because so much of the arts, but also outside of the arts, so much of this is built on relationships, right? That when they come into Australia, a lot of them don't have those existing relationships with people within Australia who could allow them to showcase their work or give them the opportunities. And a lot of times they actually don't even know where to look because there's no one database that tells you, okay, you entered Australia. Are you a visual artist, a filmmaker or whatever? This is where you can go. You know, a lot of it is just kind of like fumbling, groping. You may not be connected to the communities. You may not know who's in those communities. And so oftentimes it's those connections that they don't have. And there's a recent playwright that I met with in my work at Performing Lines, and I don't want to use their name, but they're a very well-established playwright in their home country, but most of their work is in their native language. And it's very beautiful and amazing work, but they just don't have access to translation services where their work can actually be translated into English. So then there could be a possibility of that work being presented in some kind of venue or with some actors. So there's just so many obstacles in the way to getting there that even though he has a very strong practice, the lack of language, the connections, how do you translate this work? They're just, those opportunities just aren't there for those kind of people. So I think it becomes very hard in that kind of way where you don't have like a guide or a map or anything for you to just kind of be like, okay, this is where I fit in. This is where I can go to like get this. Even for me, like there's a lot of producers who were dancers before or venue managers or, you know, everyone has kind of like taken on so many different positions. And so the art sector is very, very small. So when a new person comes in, like when I came in, everyone knew I was the new person. And everyone would like come to introduce me. And I was just like this one brown person, let alone the fact that I cover my head in a sea of just like white people. And so everyone knew who I was, and it was hilarious because everyone would like come up to me and introduce themselves, and it was just like so many white people that I just like didn't remember anyone's name or face, and everyone was just the same. And now I meet people like 7 months later and they're like, oh, we met you there. And I'm like, oh shit, we met? I don't remember you. So it's just like this idea of those relationships are actually really, really important in this line of work. And there's so many, like one of my colleagues, she trained as a dancer, you know, and so she has all those connections from the dance community now that she can like build on in so many ways. And I don't have any memory or experience of those kind of art practitioners within Australia. So everyone is new to me, and it takes time for them to get to know your art and for you to get to know them. And that's not a bad thing in itself. It's just one more layer of disadvantage that like slows the process down a little bit more. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer.
Thank you. That was a really good answer. It was very thorough. And it is about relationships and connections, and that does take time. So, Zainab, you were talking about how often there's a kind of stereotyped idea about the kinds of stories that you should be telling as a person of colour, and that they aren't, say, positions, you being in a position of authority or kind of in a position of privilege, or having that autonomy, but they should be the refugee story or the story.
Some disadvantaged story
or being victimized. Do you want to talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, I always find it very interesting when most of the stories that I see on stage from culturally diverse people are stories about identity, because I think that is one of like the biggest things that everyone kind of grapples with. But I often find that work that is showcased in a lot of venues that are new to the whole culturally diverse community showcase a lot of work that speaks mostly to that idea of like everyone in the culturally diverse community is a victim. And I think someone like me, I actually am considered to be like the 1% of my community. You know, I get to do whatever I love. If I don't love what I do, I can quit my job anytime. My parents let me go into the arts. There was no expectation from me. I come from a very privileged like socioeconomic background. And so for me, I always occupied spaces of privilege, and I am very comfortable in white spaces and international spaces because I grew up in those spaces. And so when I came to Australia, I found it so interesting that people would try to box me into like, oh, like, what was your experience? Did your family have to like leave the country? I'm like, no, actually, my parents just decided voluntarily to move back to Pakistan and just built a house there and are loving life and are, you know, like living life. And, you know, so those stories, I think, don't kind of sugarcoat a lot of the issues. And I think globally, the issue that we're struggling with is that the rhetoric of hate is winning over the rhetoric of love. And we are actually tied much more in our universality than we are separated. And I think art serves to remind us of those very fundamental human values of like love and compassion. And I think when you try to sideline those ideas and bring in this idea of just like victimhood and hate, it actually derails the process of the kind of community and the world that we want to live in and the kind of world that we can reimagine. And so I think a lot of times I've tried to fight that narrative by creating work and creating opportunities and curating spaces that actually allow us to fight the rhetoric of hate with the rhetoric of love, because I don't have it in me to shout more, to be louder than someone else. Sometimes you just got to be silent and bring the pressure down a little bit. And I think people listen to silence and people listen to softness and people respond to it much more than they respond to the rhetoric of hate and of ranting and of anger, because there's something that's fundamentally primal within us and is something that connects all of us in a lot of ways. And so I think that we shouldn't shy away from sharing those stories that actually bring us together in a universality of values, because that's something that ties all of us together. So they may be like a brown person or a white person, but they both feel love and sadness and hope in similar ways, and everyone has an experience of that. And if you can resonate with those feelings within people, I think we can work towards a society that looks very much like this kind of society we want to belong to. So I think in a lot of ways, that's kind of the challenge for us as culturally diverse artists, to like sit in a space and see what kind of art we can create that like brings us together in a lot of ways. And I'm trying to do that through poetry, and I'm hoping that other people can do that through whatever art that they're best at.
Can I ask you to maybe not freestyle, but can you recite a few lines of?
So I wrote this poem just after Trump won, because it was the only way I knew how to fight the rhetoric of hate with love. When my children ask me what I did when they turned back the boats, I will tell them the only wisdom that helps me sleep at night is from an Aboriginal poet who says, the revolution is alive within us, and justice is inevitable like death. We will all be leveled one day. So I broke down every border within me and asked them to make homes on this soil. I gave them my bleeding heart. I opened my palms and said, come, this world may have us wilt long before our time, but come, let us sing a different song. It will be the hardest fight we will ever fight. When my children ask me what I did with all of the ugly,
I will tell them I fell in love many times with the way the sun always comes back up. And yes, on most days, I am just trembling hands searching for God and this life he gave me that doesn't feel much like a gift when there are bombs everywhere. On those days, I remind myself not to be like Babylon or Ephesus, so rigid I dry out. I remind myself we are all written into this earth as fireflies lighting up the night, so I will not write another hopeless poem. I will not teach any rhymes to win except the ones that win hearts. I will empty out my insides, become a vessel like candle wax, be the fall that helps the water flow. And when my tongue can no longer carry the weight of these words, I will take up the string instrument so the stars can stand to testify that I have loved and I have lost, and I have come back from it to love even more, and maybe somewhere there will be another heart that will sing with me. When my children ask me what I did when they expected me to shout to defend my truth, I will tell them, I built myself into an Hagia Sophia, stood in the middle of the streets of Istanbul as proof that no matter the wars outside, no matter how they try to strip me of faith, to hollow me of love, no matter my scaffolding and chipping paint, there will always be enough windows in me to let the light in.
Wow.
Hope that worked.
That was amazing. That was pretty beautiful. I just want to listen to that. Can I get a Zainab no Siad? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been amazing. That was Zainab Siad, performance poet and associate producer at Performing Lines WA in Perth.
My parents' love story started with the love of durians, the king of fruit. In 1984, during a hot and sticky durian season, my Chinese dad, Tan Kim Siong, met my Indian mum, Madhavi Malyathan, in a durian plantation in Malimau, Malacca.
This is an excerpt from the Chindian Diaries Project. It's an oral history project looking at the intermarriage of Chinese and Indian couples across Southeast Asia and the Pacific, made by our friend Kevin Bathman. Just like Zainab, Kevin Bathman doesn't fit into the typical boxes that the art sector prescribes onto artists from culturally diverse backgrounds, and he's struggled to find audiences for his work in Australia. So in Australia, when we talk about first generation, we talk about people who've migrated here and were born elsewhere. I know it's different in the US, but in Australia it's so people like my parents who migrated here would be considered first generation, whereas I was born here, so I'd be second generation. Kevin migrated here as an adult, so he's a first generation artist.
Hi, I'm Kevin Bathman. I'm a creative producer, designer and arts worker in Sydney.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining me today. Now, I just want to ask you, because you and I have had a lot of discussions in the office about the difference between first and second generation artists and the experiences of first generation creative producers, artists, directors, as compared to second generation. And I'm second generation. So I am often in a position where I am speaking about these issues. And often a lot of first generation artists don't get afforded that same opportunity. So there's quite often a lot of second, as you've reminded me, you know, the experiences are actually kind of quite different. And you're someone who is first generation. You've been here just over 10 years in Australia. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about what some of the differences are, because I do think it's important. If we're going to make change happen, we can't do it. You know, it's not one size fits all. We need to understand the diversity within diversity.
Yeah, I guess that all came about because my friendship circle, as I said, is sort of split into two, you know, where I have friends from the first generation migrants, new migrants, people have been here 3-4 years. And, you know, I'm also involved with people who are involved in settlement and all that. And then you have the second generation where people who are, you know, kind of involved in the community sector, the art sector, government. And I suppose there are really distinctions between those two. And I guess for me, it's, you know, when I talk to the first group, you know, people who were migrants, for a lot of reasons, they don't even really resonate with the works being produced by second generation, you know, because it's not telling them the stories that they know, you know. And I guess because they feel much more compelled to get stories from their home countries because they are much more connected to, you know, where their family and relatives still living there, as opposed to the second generation. You know, it's not a right or wrong sort of scenario, but I suppose when we're speaking about the Celt experience, you know, there are diversities even within it, you know.
And for those of you who might not have heard episode one, the term CALD is an acronym for culturally and linguistically diverse and is kind of one of those blanket terms that people use for people from migrant, refugee, non-English speaking background.
And I guess one of the examples, you know, I used to give is, you know, there's a Malaysian filmmaker that I'm really passionate about, and her name is Yasmin Ahmad. And there's a certain way where she tells a story where it's, you know, in many ways, in an Australian way, in Australian sort of sensibilities, you know, they find it quite, I guess, a bit sappy, you know, and a bit kind of like, oh, that's just too mushy for us, you know. But to an Asian audience, you know, they love it, you know. They have the sense that, you know, this really works in our culture, you know. And
so, Kevin, can you give me, you know, a specific example of one of your experiences as a first generation migrant that perhaps a second generation migrant wouldn't have had?
Yeah, so about 5-6 years ago, I started just researching about my cultural heritage and my grandparents and where they came from and all that. And so, you know, hence a project came about called Chindians, where it's, you know, this whole mixed marriages between Chinese and Indian cultures, particularly focused at Southeast Asia, at that time. Anyway, so, I did that, and then I started talking to some other, I guess, producers, and I found that, you know, they found it really hard to connect to it. You know, I mean, some of the comments I got was, you know, but where's the Australian connection in this, you know? And to me, I was a bit kind of, well, they're human stories, you know, why should there be an Australian connection? You know what I mean? I just feel that it's, they're universal human stories, and that, you know, and that applies to anyone, any human really, or in any societies, in any countries.
Okay.
It has to be, because it's tied to funding.
Because wasn't considered to be, inverted commas, contemporary Australian enough.
It wasn't, there was no connection to Australia.
Even though you live here and you are, you know, because I know this work, you're, as you would call yourself, Chindian, Indian. Yeah.
Because a lot of the stories were about people living in those countries, you know, so they found it really hard to connect to it because there was no connection to people here, essentially.
But we have big communities here of people who are Chinese and Indian and Chindian as well. Yeah. So
absolutely.
So we need to re-educate funders and arts organisations around that, because they made assumptions that there weren't audiences.
Yeah.
But I know your work, and there have been audiences locally for your work.
Particularly about 2 years ago when the work was exhibited in Paramasala, a South Asian arts festival in Parramatta. It had a lot of interest from people from India, particularly, and South Asia, because I think it was such a new topic for them. It was so out of this world in for many people, because they've never seen those communities or those mixed marriages, you know. So that was the feedback that I got, you know. And so, you know, in essence, there is an audience for the kind of work that I want to do. But because I couldn't really show a very strong connection to Australians or to people living here, or to the art sector, essentially, I found it really hard to tap into funding. I guess I got really disheartened, and I didn't really want to do it anymore. I just thought, well, I'm just going to do it my own way, and I'm not going to depend on what the funding requires me to do, you know?
Mm. So I guess one of the advantages of being here for many generations is that you would be better at being able to access kind of funding and know how to work the system. And do you think that is a big obstacle for first generation artists, that they don't always know how to access the system and how to use the language that is designed? And I don't literally mean English. I mean the specific kind of arts languages of the bureaucracies here, who often want the language they use spoken back to them via the grant applications.
Definitely. I mean, I've had numerous conversations with people who, you know, who were sort of doing a bit of, you know, who were involved in the art sector back in Asia, and they found it really hard to access it as well, and not just in terms of writing it, but they found the whole process quite tedious, and they didn't really quite know how to go about doing it as well, you know. And I think for me, I mean, there was a lot of trial and error doing this and asking around, getting mentors and all that. And it was only true by trial and error that I got to understand how it all worked, you know. So, but that takes a lot of determination, a lot of time investment as well, which a lot of first generation migrants would not have, you know, because they would be too busy trying to settle in, trying to, you know, pay the mortgage and get a job and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, so it's a huge barrier for them to even consider doing the arts, you know, particularly if they have, even have kids, you know, that's even, like, it's not even in their sort of like, you know, in their mind frame at all, because it's just, there's just too many barriers for them to even get involved in it, you know.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for doing this today and sharing your knowledge and insight.
Thank you.
And that was Kevin Bathman. Thanks, Kevin. Let's play darts. In this regular segment of our podcast, we hear the wonderful Sonia Merman from Diversity Arts Australia asking an artist three quick questions and seeing if their answers hit the dartboard. Today's lucky contestant is...
My name is Rowena Gonsalves.
What needs to change in the art scene, in the art sector, to increase the kind of diversity that your work, that all the artists, all the writers' works here are bringing to the table?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's an important question because at the moment, the story that Australia tells itself and tells the world is one of a very monocultural white nation. However, our reality, particularly in the urban metros of Australia, is that we're a very multicultural nation. And actually, diversity was part of this continent even before white colonization. So we have hundreds and hundreds of indigenous communities with their own internal diversity. There are over 300 languages spoken in Australia. But we don't see as much of that complexity and nuance in the story we tell about the country. And so my work is part of a tradition of... people who are trying to tell a different story. So I call it the literary selfie of a country. You know, we're kind of trying to like represent ourselves and tell our own stories, which are different from the dominant hegemonic narrative.
So would that be like the direct literary selfie? Would that be the direct opposite of other people's narratives?
Yeah, it's the opposite of other people telling your story. So you take control of your own story and tell it yourself. And of course, it's easy for me to say that, because for that to happen, you not only have to be able to tell your story yourself, but also have access to pathways to publication and prestige, etc., which is controlled by the gatekeepers who are white. Change needs to happen on many different levels.
Have you yourself experienced barriers to becoming a published writer because of your diverse background?
Yes, so it took me 18 years to have a book out, 18 years of living in this country, for a variety of reasons, some of them personal and some of them systemic. It's very hard as someone who's not white and who doesn't have access to networks to get noticed and published. Now I feel like I am part of a literary community because I contribute to the community and in turn I am supported. I guess I see that as a privilege, having access to literary networks in this country. But there are a lot of people who don't have that access, but who are fantastic writers themselves, and so their voices don't get heard. So we have to think of ways in which to help their voices be heard as well.
Do you have any advice to people in that position?
I think just be open to the kinds of stories that are coming out. And this is for people who run festivals, who publish, make decisions about what to publish in literary journals, booksellers, etc. So the gatekeepers, the people who award prizes, people on judging committees. I guess be open to people who are telling their own stories, particularly those whose voices have not been heard before. So people from minority communities where dominant cultures have told the stories of minority communities. For example, indigenous communities, they are so used to a long history of white people telling their stories. And I think we need to really champion, firstly, indigenous writers telling their own stories. So being open to different stories and being open to different kinds of usages of English, the way English is used, and being open to, I guess, literary influences that are outside of the Western canon. So that's important. A lot of minority writers draw inspiration from canons that are not Western. And that brings another level of richness, I think, to the literary world.
We also want to celebrate those parts of the creative sector that are doing great things to promote cultural diversity in the way that they work by handing out 5 virtual gold stars. This week's winner is UC Monsters, a film about the power of art to challenge assumptions, subvert racism, and change the way we view the world by challenging the negative or ambivalent attitudes towards Muslims in Australia. The Colour Cycle podcast is brought to you by Diversity Arts Australia, an organisation that advocates for an arts and screen sector that represents, looks like, feels like the real Australia. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts and go to our website, diversityarts.org.au, where you can hear earlier episodes or watch videos about our work. Leave a comment on our Facebook page or record a message on your phone and email it to us. The email address again is info@diversityarts.org.au. This week's feedback is from Pat.
Hey guys, I just wanted to call in and say great job, love the podcast. I'm an author of comics and I've been struggling with a lot of the issues that you're talking about for years now. It's really great to get a whole bunch of different perspectives on representation in media. Keep it up. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Pat. Thanks everyone who's been commenting via our Facebook page on the Colour Cycle podcast series. And thanks for all the sharing of the episodes that have been happening. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you took the trouble to go to iTunes and rate the podcasts, as it really helps other people find the Colour Cycle. We'd like to acknowledge Create New South Wales and the Australia Council for supporting the establishment of this podcast series, and to thank our partners at Casula Powerhouse Arts Centre and Information and Cultural Exchange in Parramatta. We've just moved our offices to ICE and we're using their beautiful sound studios to record this episode. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy from Audiocraft. Tarek Sawires composed our title track. Extra music was by Terumi Narashima and Paul Macy. I'm Lina Nahlus. Thanks for listening and Masalemi. Yalla, bye.